This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern was an early critic of the current war in Iraq. He could see that evidence was being fabricated to create a pretext for invasion. Thousands of lives and more than $1 trillion were lost in the ensuing war. Now he fears the U.S. could be going down another disastrous road, this time with Iran. Ray McGovern worked for the CIA from the 1960s through the 80s. He's co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals, a Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which was created to expose the way intelligence was falsified to justify war in Iraq. He spoke about his concerns to the Community Church of Chapel Hill yesterday, and he is here today. Welcome back, Ray. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
You were an early critic of this war in Iraq. What are the parallels, if any, between what happened there in the run-up to that war and what we're hearing now about Iran?
The parallels are striking. The same people who are plumbing for an attack on Iraq, saying it would be a cakewalk, are precisely the same folks in the media and in high levels of our government that are pressing for an attack on Iran. There are significant differences, though. I'm happy to report that the intelligence community is being honest this time. They've been insisting since late 2007 that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, mind you, and have not resumed that work. Equally important is that the intelligence service of Israel says the same thing, and our defense ministers also have said, as Panetta and Ehud Barak have said, that Iran has not yet decided whether to make a nuclear weapon. If I understand English, that means they are not working on a nuclear weapon.
So now when you say people in high levels in government, the government has certainly changed, at least the administration, and Congress has rolled over a few times. Who in the highest levels of government is making this claim?
Well, Congress is still in very much in bed with what Netanyahu wants to do. But Barack Obama clearly does not want a war on Iran. And he's told that to Netanyahu. My problem is that he won't say that out loud.
How do you know he's told it to him in private?
Well, it's very, very clear on the 5th of March that he made it clear to Netanyahu that it would be a disaster. And he sent all manner of emissaries to Tel Aviv to tell him the same thing. The problem with that I have is that unless he's willing to say that publicly, I think that Netanyahu can easily conclude, and I dare say he'd probably be right, that were he to start a hostile conflict with Iran or provoke one, that the President of the United States, particularly in an election year, would have no option other to jump in with both feet to defend our non-ally ally, Israel, for whatever it took.
Well, the president's a pretty bright politician. He has to understand the pressures of electoral politics. Doesn't he see that coming?
Well, he does see that coming, and that's why I would hope that he would have the spine to stand up and say publicly that you, Netanyahu, if you start a war, we're not in automatically. There are going to be a lot of pieces, 1,000 pieces to pick up. We're not going to pick them up for you. Unless he says that, there's an equal chance that Netanyahu will say, look, you know, if I move before the election, I can really embarrass this president and may indeed ensure that he is not reelected, because Netanyahu's fear is that if Barack Obama gets reelected, he will feel free. He will be much more unfettered by considerations of the Israel lobby in this country, and he might try to actually act as an honest broker in the Palestinian-Israeli dispute for the first time since before George Bush. Now, one of the main attractions for Netanyahu and the hard-right Israeli leaders is that by hyping the, quote, threat from Iran, end quote, the Palestinian issue has been put not in second place, but sort of like in fifth place. It's hardly mentioned anymore. Meanwhile, Israeli settlements go up in the occupied territories. They keep creating facts on the ground. And that's what's lost to the American public, because the media is noticeably mute on those subjects.
Well, before we dismiss utterly the threat from Iran, the reports you say go back to 2007, when we felt that's when they ended, that Iran ended its nuclear program. I mean, that's a while ago. It's 2012.
Yeah, but it's been reiterated every year. And that, to my great delight, the intelligence community has played it on us this time, as recently as earlier, well, last year. The head of national intelligence said the same thing. Panetta, very interestingly, when he was on Face the Nation on the 8th of January. I know how these things work, and I imagine he told Bob Schieffer ahead of time, listen, don't forget to ask me whether Iran is working on a nuclear weapon, okay? Schieffer chickened out. And so I see Panetta looking at his watch 5 minutes later. So apropos of nothing, he says, is Iran working on a nuclear weapon? No. Well, hello. Now, what people don't realize is that the Israeli defense minister 10 days later said exactly the same thing in an interview with Israeli Army Radio. The first question, do you share the American view that Iran has not decided to work on a nuclear weapon? Yes. Next question. Well, when they decide to do a nuclear weapon, how long do you think it would take before they got one? Ehud Barak, and this is a direct quote, it doesn't matter, because to do that, they would have to throw out the UN inspectors. Come around after they do that and then ask me, okay? Then I'll give you an educated guess. But until they throw out the UN inspectors, they're not going to be able to do anything on the nuclear weapons side of things. And that is why we have a reasonable assurance that they have not decided to do a nuclear weapon. So all this stuff is lost in the media where at last polling, and this is shocking, the last poll that I'm aware of, and it does go back 2 years, is that 70% of the American people believed that Iran already had a nuclear weapon. And that's exactly the same percentage that believed prior to the war in Iraq that Saddam Hussein was working on a nuclear weapon and that he had ties with al-Qaeda. So this is very, very disturbing, and it speaks volumes about the diet, about the malnourishment of the American public from the what's called the mainstream media.
What do we know about the conventional capabilities of Iran? Should we go to war, what would we be dealing with?
Well, that's why the military as well as the intelligence community is dead set against a war. The Persian Gulf is not all that big a body of water. The strait, such as it is, where the ships go through, is even narrower. Admiral Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was asked 2 years ago, could the Iranians shut down the Strait of Hormuz, through which 20 to 30% of the world's oil and trade passes? And Mullen sort of gulped and he said, yes, they could. And then he thought from these, but we could reopen them. Well, I suggest that your listeners look at the Google Maps of the Strait of Hormuz and take a look at those cliffs that are on the Iranian side. Not only that, but you're going to have Marines climb up those cliffs. You're going to have Marines come around through Yemen. What Marines? What Marines are you going to use? And besides that, there are all manner of PT boats, skimming missiles, and the Iranians could wreak havoc and sink a whole lot of U.S. ships as well as other ships in the Persian Gulf.
And that's the straits, but in terms of their military capability, is it comparable to what we met in Iraq, superior?
No, inferior? No, it's much superior, yeah. You don't have a country flat on its back from sanctions, and at least not yet. You have a decent navy as far as their objectives and strategic goals are, and you have a pretty strong army and some surface-to-air missiles that could down a whole bunch of planes, including Israeli planes.
What does Israel hope to gain by going to war with Iran at this point?
Well, again, we have to be careful. This is Netanyahu and a small coterie of hardliners in the Israeli government. The Israeli people are dead set against it, even by a higher majority than the Americans. But what they'd like to do is give Iran a bloody nose and, more important, show that they still have the full support of the sole remaining superpower in the world, okay? Israel's had the worst year in its history. It's lost Egypt, 73 million people to its south that were completely domesticated by Mubarak and now are showing their oats and actually care about the Palestinians to the north. Turkey, that didn't really appreciate having its people killed by Israeli patrol boats, and the military ties that used to exist between Turkey and Israel have dissipated. And they've got all kinds of other problems at the UN and elsewhere. They are isolated now. What better way to show that, isolated though they may be, if they have the sole remaining superpower in the world coming to their defense once they start a war with Iran, well, that should speak volumes to the world about how powerful Israel remains. That's a very short-sighted view, very myopic, and it would redound to Israel's not benefit for it to get involved in this kind of thing, because over the long run, Israel's going to have to work out some sort of compromise unless it intends to ethnically cleanse 3 million Palestinians.
Well, you have a leader in Iran right now who is not only anti-Israel but downright anti-Semitic. He has proved that, and he has probably reinforced any of the stereotypes about fundamentalism in that part of the world. Isn't he a more dangerous actor for Israel, and isn't Israel right, or even parts of the Israeli government, sections of that government, to be very nervous about a leader like the one in Iran today?
Well, if you're referring to Ahmadinejad, number one, he's not really the leader of Iran. The mullahs still hold all the power. He's president, but not for very much longer, and he suffered an electoral reverse just a few weeks ago. The question is whether he said, as our president claimed in his speech before the Israel lobby of AIPAC, whether Ahmadinejad said that he was going to wipe Israel off the map. That's what the president said. The president knows that Ahmadinejad never said that. That's a mistranslation for political purposes. And to hear our president misrepresent what the president of Iran said really is painful. What Ahmadinejad said is, and I quote, "The regime in Jerusalem shall pass from the pages of history," okay? End quote. Nothing about driving Israel into the sea. Nothing about using nuclear weapons to destroy Israel. And so this is the crudest kind of propaganda. And to hear it repeated by President Barack Obama is just very painful.
Yeah, but you've got to admit, wiping you from the pages of history sounds like a pretty serious threat.
It wasn't wiping. Mm-hmm. It was, "The regime in Jerusalem shall disappear from the pages of history." He was quoting Khomeini, who said precisely the same thing about the Soviet Union. And actually, Khomeini turned out to be right, didn't he?
Now, when it comes to Ahmadinejad, he's a guy who comes to power as a hardliner after a much more moderate leader in Iran who was practically driven from office in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when our president at the time named Iran as one of the axis of evil. In a sense, taking a hard line with Iran pushes Iran farther to the right, it seems to me. Is that one of the reasons why maybe we should take a different tack with them?
Well, the history is really complicated. Right after the attack on Iraq, the Iranians came to us with a wide set of proposals for compromise, including compromise in the nuclear program. Okay, at that time, they were still working on a nuclear weapon. They stopped at the end of 2003. And so when that was rejected, what you have is a harder line in Iran, and you have Ahmadinejad coming to power. Now, one of the other things that is distorted in our media is the election in 2009 is always described with the adjective disputed election, that Ahmadinejad was elected in a disputed election. Well, that's bull, okay? He won fair and square. And you know where he won? He won with the people who are downtrodden, the people who needed help, the poor people in Iran, where he has quite a huge following. And you know what the 1% accused Ahmadinejad of seeking votes by giving food and hospital supplies and other social services to these poor people? Well, you know, that's my idea of what a political leader is supposed to do. So don't be misled by this disputed election. He won fair and square. We ought to really deal with it.
You left the CIA after more than two decades. Why did you leave?
Well, actually, it's a complex of reasons. I had done pretty much what I wanted to do. I ended up briefing down at the White House every other morning. I chaired a couple of national intelligence estimates, the supreme genre of the analytical product. And the country that I was most involved with analyzing, the Soviet Union, had just imploded. The ethos of the analysis division was beginning to erode under the impact of Bill Casey and Bobby Gates who believed that the Soviet Union would never disappear, that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union would exist forever. And I was 50 years old. And in those days, if you served enough time overseas, you were allowed to retire at 50 and get some sort of reduced but immediate annuity. I wanted to work down in the inner city of Washington, and I saw an opportunity to go out and try to find a nonprofit job. And so I left in early 1990, divorced myself from this kind of study until I saw our profession, the intelligence profession, the intelligence analysis profession, being corrupted in the same way that the medical and psychology professions were corrupted with the torture they participated in. Here, in my case, I watched my former colleagues decide that if George Bush wanted to do a war, that they would dredge up, they would invent, they would forge the kind of evidence that the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee later called, after a five-year study, uncorroborated, contradicted, or even non-existent. That was it. You know, it doesn't get any worse than that. What they did was make it possible for Congress to be deceived out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. It doesn't get any worse than that. That's why we set up our Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and we wish that the president would have listened to us.
You say things have changed, and yet, you know, the CIA is an agency that has far less accountability than any of the others in our democracy. Why change? Why bother? You don't have to.
Well, there are two CIAs, Frank. This is what people need to realize. The CIA in which I worked was the one that Truman had in mind. The operational part of the CIA was not what Truman had in mind. And before he died, he bitterly accused the CIA of becoming the kind of operational cloak and dagger regime change. In those days, we used to say overthrowing governments, okay? Regime change kind of thing that he had never intended. Now, the interesting thing is he wrote that all down in an op-ed in the Washington Post, 22nd of December, 1963. So exactly 1 month after the assassination of John Kennedy. He did that advisedly. We can see it from his papers in the Truman Library. If you read James Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable, you will get an appreciation of what Truman knew to be the case in terms of the cashiered Alan Dulles and other people who were hell-bent on making sure that John Kennedy did not succeed, and some of them hell-bent on making sure that John Kennedy did no longer live.
Yeah, but that's about the time you got started in the agency, or you were in full bloom. You didn't leave then. 60s?
Well, I came down under John Kennedy. I was one of those folks that listened to his inaugural and said, hey, maybe I could do something for my country. I came down in April of 63. You know, when I talk about two agencies, I mean it. We were hermetically sealed against the folks that overthrew governments. We didn't know any more that was going on than the New York Times, sometimes less, okay? Now, this is simply to say that part of the agency was justified by one sentence that was inserted into the National Security Act of 1947 to justify bringing the OSS, the regime changers, the covert operators into the agency. And that sentence reads, the Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence as the president shall from time to time direct. Now, for an unscrupulous president and a sycophant head of intelligence, you have the makings of the president's own personal Gestapo. Do not blanch before that word. Look at the torture. Look at the kidnapping. Look at the secret prisons. So the only check on that is supposed to be the U.S. Congress. They're called the oversight committees, but over the last decade or so, they have been the overlook committees. They're too afraid to check the CIA because they might be accused of being soft on, used to be communism, now it's terrorism.
Ray, I've got about 3 seconds left. The likelihood of war with Iran, in your opinion?
You know, I consider it 50-50, and the big point here is Netanyahu has the initiative, and if he has the impression that our president will automatically be mousetrapped and be cornered into supporting Israel, I believe the chances are slightly better than even that he will strike out on Iran.
Marie McGovern, former CIA analyst, now works in inner-city Washington, D.C. Just ahead on the state of things, the topic of intelligence continues with a play at Common Ground Theater. Stay tuned.